PAs, allies, and anybody that wants to learn more about the LGBT plus community. My name is Zanardi, and I'm so glad all your beautiful faces are here. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Alphabet Mafia podcast. Wow, my guest today is just spectacular. I have no idea what my dumbass is doing talking to a man so intelligent, so filled with knowledge. His name is Dr. David Ross. You might know him as Professor Ross over on TikTok. Big fan of his TikTok account. He is a professor, given his name, Professor Ross, at a major U.S. institution. I'm not going to give away the name of his higher learning institution, but it is a major one that a lot of people know. He teaches classes in entrepreneurship, management, various business classes, but he's very well versed in the Bible and what the Bible says about homosexuality, the actual context of the time it was written. And so a lot of our conversation revolves around homosexuality in the Bible and how Christians or people who believe in the Bible can be more accepting of the LGBT community. Given his academic career, we also talk about women in the workplace and the gender pay gap. We talk about gender roles, how gender roles are assigned, why gender roles are assigned, and the history of gender roles, just in general. Anyway, I had a wonderful conversation with Dr. David Ross, aka Professor Ross, over on TikTok. So go check him out after you're done listening to this. And everyone, give it up for Dr. David Ross. Dr. Ross, thank you for coming on the show. Welcome.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And so how are you doing today? How are you doing in quarantine? How's that life been?
Well, I have to tell you, the campus is awfully quiet. Now, it would be a little bit because we're between terms. But yeah, it's a little bit like a ghost town with everyone gone, including the staff. Sure.
Did you? And so why don't we just take a step back and introduce yourself just to kind of tell the audience just a little bit about yourself, what you do?
Sure. So I'm David Ross. I worked for many years as an evil investment banker on Wall Street. Yes, I know that's redundant. And then I went back, got a PhD in economics, and now I teach various topics related in business. But my specialty, as far as research goes, is gender-related issues in management, especially top management. And I have other interests that are related, for example, you know, sexuality and that kind of thing, which I anticipate discussing with you today.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm a big fan of your work on TikTok. I think you make some excellent videos. Real quick, before we get into that, I'm curious, how was teaching online? Like, is that something that you personally prefer, or was it weird, or what was the adjustment like?
Well, we could do an entire podcast on that, but the PR is that it's not, at least until they invent like one of those Marvel comic kind of technologies where you can literally have you virtually next to me in the classroom, so to speak, online.
Yeah.
You can't just take the classroom experience to the computer. I'm sure every one of your listeners who's taken a class has noticed this. So you do have to tweak it a little bit, but I think we're getting better at it. And I think it can work. And certainly it's very, very scalable in a way that, teaching live is not, which might mean that we could, knock on wood, make tuition a little lower someday, but one can always hope. So,
yeah, totally. That's obviously a huge issue that's stemming. And didn't Biden recently come out and say he's forgiving student debt?
Well, he's announced a plan, which, of course, he couldn't literally implement by himself. Just like this, he's not running for king, he's running for president. But he has introduced a plan to try to start forgiving people's debt from college as long as they aren't rich, you know, which people who graduate college or not. I mean, frankly, as you probably know, in most countries in the world, like Europe, for example, college is massively subsidized. It's not like they don't charge people at all, but they feel like it's good for the entire society that you get your degree because you become more productive. So everyone gets helped out a little bit. In the US, we're charging people $25,000 to go to a state school. It's crazy. And so something has to be done.
Oh, totally. I'm on board with that. So let's talk about a little bit about your expertise. I want to talk about the gender pay gap. I know you study gender a lot and you've written some theses or presentations on it. How does the pay gap work? And I'm genuinely curious because, you know, I've heard both sides of the aisle. I've heard, you know, that it's because women don't accept the types of jobs that men accept, it's because they go on maternity leave. And then I've also heard that it is a totally real thing. And I haven't put too much thought into it. I'm not convicted either way, but what are your thoughts on it? How does that work?
Well, okay. So I think let's back up a step or two here. Sure. What literally is the gender pay gap. Mm. So there's basically two ways of thinking about it. The simplest way is to simply take all the women or all the men, either in a particular organization, like a company, or an entire country, like the USA, and just calculate how much the average woman makes and the average man makes who are working, you know, not like a homemaker or something. And when you do that in the US, I mean, or other countries, I mean, it really does depend where you are, but you might find that women make, you know, 25% less, let's say, you know, 75 cents in the dollar. Mm-hmm. So that's like a very simple gender pay gap. And there are many, many explanations for it. You know, maybe women are only working part-time, maybe they have different jobs. It doesn't necessarily prove that there's discrimination, but it could be a sign of discrimination. When it comes to a more rigorous measure of the gender pay gap, like if you were going to sue an organization like a university, oh, you're not paying your female professors enough, or, you know, you're a big company and you're not paying the women there enough, or the country as a whole has a problem. What lawyers, their consultants, and social scientists do is they conduct a statistical analysis. I won't get into all the details, but it's basically this. Let's try to explain how much everyone gets paid in this company, let's say, based on everything that should reasonably affect it. What job do you do? What's your education level? What are your qualifications? How long have you been working there? All this stuff. If after we've accounted for all those factors, women are still getting paid less, well, that's a gender pay gap. Mm. Now, that doesn't prove that women are being discriminated against, because there may be some things that could explain it that we can't see. You know, maybe women are taking time off for family more often than men, which wouldn't really show up in the statistical analysis. But that's the more refined way of thinking about it. And when you do things like that, you get a lower number usually, maybe a little like close to 10%, but not quite, you know, 7 or 8% on average. So the gender wage gap, it's a real statistical thing. It exists. Most studies find it. But where people start to fight a lot is why, right? That's where, you know, it becomes an issue with different explanations and so on.
Sure. And so what is your take on the why? Is it because women, like, is it because they're not accepting jobs, or they're not willing to move for higher paying jobs, or what is your opinion on that?
My personal opinion is that it's one of these things with a lot of causes going in. Mm. Some of it is that women are more, so if you have a couple, for example, and there's research that shows this, a woman's more likely to accept a lower paying job to help her husband's career. Mm-hmm. Than the reverse. This isn't just true in the U.S. I mean, you can go to countries that are sort of gender egalitarian. You think like a Denmark or a Sweden, for example. You see the same pattern, and that's obviously going to hurt women's earnings. We also have evidence that women do not fight as hard on average when they're negotiating pay. Now, why is that? Is that because we teach them not to do that as women? Oh, women are supposed to be soft and nice and motherly, or is it because they're being discriminated against by employers who think they can take advantage of them? That's a big discussion. But that's one of the factors that seems to happen. The other thing is that you're going to see a bigger pay gap the more subjective someone's pay is. Here's what I mean. If you are an employee for like a McDonald's or for the civil service, where your pay is determined very, like a public school teacher, where your pay is determined very precisely by what degree you have, how many years you've been working, and what you teach, you can't have a pay gap, because right. Factors literally determine how much you get paid down to the nearest penny. But when you have a job like, say, mine, where you might get hired at a certain salary, but then you move from school to school, and the dean might give you a raise or not in a particular year for merit, that's where you start to see this wedge open up between women and men. And it does suggest that that, you know, there's something systemic, you know, whatever, doesn't even require people to be like actively discriminated against men. Against women. There's something in the system that's causing this to happen.
Sure. Yeah, I totally understand that. And have you heard of the LGBT pay gap? Are you aware of that?
So I haven't, you know, interestingly enough, well, there's some talk about that. I've heard that specifically with reference to lesbians, that they may be discriminated against more. You know, these things can get very complicated. So I'm going to set LGBT just aside for just one second.
Sure.
It's because that's just could be invisible, you know, if someone straight presents when they're at work, when no one might ever know. But right. One of the interesting things is that most of the time, if you have someone who's in a group that might get discriminated against, it's a double whammy. So let's just talk about a black woman, for example. Mm-hmm. So she might have face a pay gap as a black person, and she might get a face a pay gap as a female, and you put those two together, and then you're talking a big gap. And yeah. We often see that. Sometimes we actually see that flip around as if the organization thinks to itself, oh, if we have a black woman, let's really, you know, promote her quickly, and we kind of get two diversity check. We can check two diversity boxes for the price of one. You know, sure. We got a woman in the top management team, and we have a black on the top management team. And so it can kind of reverse in some weird way. Okay, now let me coming back to what I think you wanted to ask about. We see some interesting things with LGBTQ. So, for example, there's some evidence out there that actually gay men overachieve. Now, that's not because people are like, oh, let's give more money and more promotions to gay men. It's usually explained that it's a way of compensating for feeling like, you know, they're socially discriminated against because of their orientation. Even if no one knows at work, it's all internalized.
Right.
They're compensating for something. But there is some evidence of that, and it can show up in, you know, working harder, moving up the corporate ranks more quickly, and so on. And that's sort of coming from within.
You know, okay.
Show them kind of thing.
Sure. Could that also be attributed to possibly, you know, maybe they're not starting a family as quickly or as often as a straight couple? You know, maybe they're in their 30s or 40s and they're single, so they're putting more time in that work.
Great question. I want to say probably that's not the reason, although I don't know this, and this is why. When couples have kids, and again, this is even true in very gender egalitarian countries, relatively speaking, you know, Norway or whatever, the men start working harder,
huh,
and the women start working less hard.
Wow.
I mean, we have a country like Sweden, you know, where everyone's like, oh, you know, equality. Well, they have, you know, well, Sweden has a male leader at the moment. A lot of these Scandinavian countries have a very good track record of having female leaders and so on. And then they're like, and so what ends up happening is the man's earnings, the husband's with a child, starts to creep up because, you know, he's putting in the extra hour, and the women start to creep down. I mean, it's amazing how these things get enacted even in places like that.
Sure. I brought up the LGBT pay gap because so I actually had a guy on the podcast named John Voltoro. He's a life coach out in LA. He works with executives. He works with many top executives, basically as their coach. Anyone who feels marginalized, he works with women, gay people of color that are in these companies. And he's gay himself, but he explained to me that the LGBT pay gap is basically a mobility. It's not that their coworker that has the same credentials and that's sitting right next to them. It's not an inequality amongst the pay between, you know, two coworkers. It's a mobility issue. So if you're out in California and, you know, you might get a promotion to the corporate office, but that happens to be in Texas, well, now are you and your husband going to accept that? Because, you know, you're worried, well, I have to go back in the closet. Is this area as accepting as my current area? And so that's kind of my understanding of what he was explaining, is that it's this feeling of not wanting to move for promotions. It's this feeling of maybe getting passed up for promotions, because if the company is, you know, secretly homophobic, they don't want, you know, a gay person be the face of the company or whatever, or an executive of a division. So that was kind of my understanding of it. I'm sure there's a ton of research that we could each do and look into that. But that's kind of, I actually just learned about that a week ago, which I was surprised because I hadn't heard of it.
Well, my reaction is that could be very well true. I mean, if the logic that you're explaining makes sense. It's a very hard thing to study. If you want to study the gender pay gap, you can download lots of public data sets or ask a company to send you their, you know, what do you call it? Their if they're willing to do it, to share their payroll with you.
Yeah.
And if they don't have gender coded, you can just go by first names most of the time. I mean, Jamie might be ambiguous, but most names you can tell. but with LGBTQ, And you know, well, you know this, obviously, there are a lot of people out there who, whatever they're, however they behave when they're, however public they are when they're not at work they're completely, you know, in the closet. So there's just no way to do that. You really would have to go out and get people to sort of tell you, you know, self-identify. So it's a much harder thing to study.
Sure.
And that's why we know less about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to women in the workforce, because I know you do some research on this, do investors favor men-led companies?
Well, that's a really good question. So there is some research out there that suggests that controlling for every other thing else, if you announce that you're hiring a new CEO, and then the reaction of the stock market is influenced by the gender of that person, and it tends to react not as well or worse if the person is a female, is a woman. So that would tend to suggest that there is some, I don't know if you want to call it sex, well, there's something in there, right?
Right.
On the other hand, I've done some research myself, and there's actually a growing body of research to the point where you can even do something called a meta-analysis, which is when you statistically combine a bunch of studies that suggest that firms that have some reasonable level of female representation at the top, could be a CEO, but it could just be some people on the top management team are not male, right? That right. They actually perform somewhat better. We're not talking like 30% better, maybe just a percent or two better on average. But you know, that's a really important thing, because there are a lot of people out there, even people who are fairly well intentioned, who will say, well, look, you know, I totally believe we need more women at the top. We need to promote more women, but I don't want to hurt the performance of the company if we do that. And you can say, well, you know, on average, it's actually a small positive boost, right?
Sure.
We see that a lot. So that just calls into question why we don't see more women at the top, of course. And that gets you into this whole discussion of why people don't get promoted and old boys network, or maybe people taking time off to, you know, one of the things that some of the high paying professional services firms are doing, like the investment banks and the consulting companies, is if they have a woman that they think is a high flyer and could, you know, really rise very hard, high in the organization, they'll work with her individually to help her manage her work family issues. You know, maybe have her transition into something that's more internal when she wants to have kids, so that it doesn't derail her and then kind of bring her back into facing customers and stuff. And that seems to work pretty well, but it requires a lot of organizational investment. You're just not going to do that for the average middle manager, right? It has to be a potential star.
Yeah. So obviously more women, you know, in the past decade, especially, you know, in the past, you know, 5 years they're entering the workforce more, I believe, right? Am I correct? Are more women starting to work than say 20 years ago?
Well, we are seeing more and more women in the workforce, and we're also seeing women tend to eclipse men in their credentialing. This is a global phenomenon. It's even happening in places like South Korea. I just picked that because it's a very different place than America culturally. And it's happening all up and down the socioeconomic ladder. So whereas it used to be the case that practically everyone who graduated medical school was a male, was a man, now women are starting to graduate medical school in greater numbers than men, and in law, but also lower down the socioeconomic scale, like getting a nursing degree, getting a radiologist degree, getting some sort of technical degree. And yeah, what we're kind of moving towards, I hate to say this, but it's almost like a three-tiered society where you still have this sort of male predominance at the very top, patriarchal, if you like. And then the next level down is dominated by women. The next level down is dominated by men, many of whom are really struggling because the old good working class jobs they would once have had at the factory down the road are disappearing. So that's kind of where things go. There's a book called The End of Men, which is a somewhat entertaining book you can read. You'll probably plow through it in just a couple of days if you get it, by Hannah Rosen, I think her name was. And she's a journalist, so she doesn't look at it scientifically. She goes and talks to a lot of people, but that's interesting in its own way.
Sure.
How men and women are trying to navigate this very different world.
So let's actually break that down. The stereotypical gender roles, you know, in the 1950s, whereas the woman was the caretaker, they cooked, they cleaned, they did the laundry. While the man went to work, obviously that is, as you just, you know, confirmed that it's switching drastically across the world, not just in the US. So what are, in your expert opinion, like, can you just like debunk the gender stereotype role of them cleaning and everything?
Well, I don't know if you mean to. I mean, look, let me say some things that will probably surprise your listeners a lot.
Okay.
The first is that people have this idea, and they have this idea about everything, including sexuality, by the way. You know, like I'm talking about orientation and stuff, that, you know, the world was basically a certain way, the traditional way, for eon upon eon, you know, all the way back to when the dragons roamed the earth, you know, for the Game of Thrones or something. And then all of a sudden the 1960s happened, everything went crazy, and oh my God, the liberals.
Yeah.
That's not true. Okay, so for most of human history, including Western history until, I don't know, early 1800s, maybe even more recently in a lot of countries, the average woman, just like the average man, worked her ass off. Mm. Backbreaking work the whole day. Even people who were relatively well off because they were part of like a cottage industry that was successful, you know, a blacksmith business, or they owned an inn in some little French town. Everyone was working their asses off. I don't want to swear.
Sure.
I was going to say.
So you can swear on the podcast.
It's okay, well, here we go. You let it all out. Anyway, what happened was that as the Industrial Revolution got going, it started in England and then spread to the rest of Europe and then the rest of the world. It took a while, of course. There started to get these good jobs that were a fairly decent trek by the standards of the time. And what happened is men started to take those jobs and women started to stay at home a little bit. And that really reached its peak in the post-World War II period, mm-hmm. which is sort of a unique period, at least in the last 1,000 years of Western history. I mean, I'm not gonna say ancient Greece, but we'll stick with the last 1,000 years.
Sure.
When, you know, I'm gonna call it the average American family. You know, the guy had a job selling used cars, or he was a police officer, or he was a postal worker, I believe, in the Honeymooners or something. You know, a solid job, was able to pay for an entire family, including maybe sending the kids to college when the time came. And the woman was this homemaker. And one of the reasons that arose is because back in the old days, when most women were working their asses off, the nobility did effectively have women who were just sort of sitting around. They didn't really work at all. They didn't even keep the house. They were just sort of the mistress of the maison. And now everyone could quasi emulate that lifestyle. So it's this thing that seems so traditional to us is actually something that's very recent. Mm. Okay, people need to understand this. You know, maybe your grandparents grew up that way, but your great grandparents did not. You know,
right.
So that's one thing. The second thing is that, you know, well, I mean, if the women are doing tons of work back in the old days, well, the men were also doing lots of childcare. Now, they weren't breastfeeding the kids because women, you know, men can't do that. And there was no formula in those days. But they were involved in various forms of, you know, training kids to do kinds of things. I'm simplifying lots of stuff. What we're trying to do now is you're trying to find a new way, a new normal that makes sense for the modern world. And I mean, just think about it. Forget right and wrong. Just forget it. Just forget what you think is right and wrong. Suppose that you were the king of the world who wanted the country to be run in the most efficient manner to produce the most in our economy. You would want to take people and put them in the job that was best for their talents, mm-hmm. regardless of whatever their sexual orientation was, whatever their race was, whatever their gender was, right? That's what you want to do. Well, most jobs now, the overwhelming majority, don't require a lot of physical strength. They require all kinds of other skills that's mostly in the brain or more dexterity in your fingers. Women are just as good at that, or they're better than men. And there are also lots of men out there. If you give them a chance, they can be good parents, or they can be good cooks and all this other kind of stuff. So a world with a lot more flexibility for people to do what they want to do. Not only is that a world where people are generally happier because they can follow their own path, it's a world where it's more efficient because people are in the jobs doing the tasks that they were like more apt to do in the beginning. And so that's what we're trying to build. That doesn't mean you can't have a traditional family where the husband's the breadwinner and the wife is a homemaker, a rock on. Just don't tell the rest of us that we have to live that way.
Yeah. So I couldn't agree more. And I think absolutely, like probably you know, and I know, and anyone listening can probably think of a few couples or where, you know, maybe that man would be a better caretaker. Maybe they're more empathetic. Maybe they just understand children more or whatever. Maybe they're just better at that type of duties. And the woman, maybe she's a rock star. Maybe she is a great marketer. Maybe she, whatever, like any business profession. But to have this stigma or this society says the man has to work and the woman has to be the breadwinner is ridiculous, because you're absolutely right. We should be doing whatever is most efficient. And I'm sure anyone listening can think of a couple or an example of where the roles could be reversed and it would actually work out for the better. So
you're absolutely right. And let me just add one thing here. What we're seeing in society, like, for example, American society, is that highly educated people are adapting pretty quickly to this new normal. You know, the man is doing just as much breast bottle feeding as the woman does, or more, or exactly as you just described it, where it makes sense. It's when you get to the less educated segments of society that men are really struggling to adapt. And I'm not pointing a finger at them and saying that they're bad people. I'm just literally describing a fact that they are having a tough time adapting. And that's creating a lot of dislocation with families all throughout the working class and lower middle class in America. It's a big problem that people aren't talking about.
So when you say uneducated, just you mean no college degree?
It's kind of like, so let's start at whatever you think most educated is. You know, you have a graduate degree or a PhD or something, and just work your way down. Okay. As you go from up here down, it becomes men are having a progressively harder time adjusting. And so the group that would be having, on average, it's always an average, the most trouble is, yes, no college degree.
Is it because the types of jobs that people without college degrees are working might be harder for a female to do, say like a car mechanic? Obviously, there's probably great female car mechanics, but just something that's a little more labor intensive, could that be a reason why?
Well, what's happening is basically, this is going to be kind of a stereotypical example. You have a town, maybe 30 years ago, the women were mostly housewives and the men had these good jobs at the local factory. That factory is now gone, or it's massively shrunk, but there are all these new jobs and things like healthcare or telemarketing or whatever. And the women have sort of seen the writing on the wall and both because of the social changes moved into these new jobs. And the men are doing neither of moving into the new jobs or upping their homemaking skills. So you have a situation, I hate to sound so callous about it, but you have a situation where there's so many men out there who might be dateable when they're in high school, but once you're in, they get to adults and you actually need someone to actually help your life and so you help the household production function.
Right.
They're not variable. And so a lot of the social ills that have been stereotypically associated with, let's say, the inner city have spread to these suburban, exurban, and rural areas. And it's a real problem. And, you know, marriage rates are declining and you kind of gets into other issues about, you know, life expectancy declining in certain population classes and so on. People are having, working class men are having a really tough time adjusting to the new jobs that exist and the new demands on them, shall we say, around the house.
Are you a fan of UBI?
Income?
Yeah.
Wow, are you an Andrew Yang supporter? Or?
I was very much for Andrew Yang. You know, when he was running, when he had come out with his platform. I was sold by him. So I would say, admittedly, yes, I'm a fan of UBI.
I am a fan of, again, just leaving right or wrong completely aside. I am a fan of the country, whether it's America or somewhere else, doing a lot more to invest in preventing individual people and neighborhoods or towns from falling into social dysfunction. Not only do the people who are involved in the actual dysfunction suffer greatly from that, but they become a drag on society in all kinds of ways. Crime need to be, you know, they're not producing anything the rest of us can need. They may draw on the wealth, social services, and things like that. UBI is a reasonable but expensive way of dealing with that. You can also do things that are more traditionally part of many European and East Asian, well, mostly European societies, where they work more with training programs. And because a lot of people don't realize this, but these so-called social democratic Scandinavian countries have historically had fairly rigorous, like, yes, they'll spend a lot of money getting you trained so that you can get a job, but they're expecting you to stay with that program. Throw money at you. You know what I'm saying? So in a way, as long as it's done in kind of intelligent manner, I think you can do it with UBI. You can do it with something that's more like, no, you have to learn how to become this machinist or something like that. So because we're not going to pay you on welfare forever, but we ought to be doing something. I mean, the idea that we can just sit back and let the market solve these social problems, I think is hopeful at best and mean-spirited at worst.
Oh, totally. kind of touching on how you're saying that men are struggling, especially adapting to, you know, the new normal with factories being shut down or even any type of childcare, is toxic masculinity, or I guess we shouldn't even label it that, is masculinity in general a, is it, I guess, is it toxic? Let's talk about that. So is there a toxic side to masculinity that is damaging communities and individuals? But real quick, I want to thank you all for listening. You know what's masculine? Having a lot of hair on your balls. But that's also kind of gross, at least in my opinion. And that is where Manscaped comes in. If you're a listener of the show, you know that Manscaped has been a sponsor for a few weeks now. And we had to change the promo code. It's not GayFam anymore. It is now GayFam20. So just keep that in mind, GayFam20. But Manscaped is the only men's grooming brand dedicated to below-the-waist grooming. Manscaped is forever changing the grooming game with their Lawnmower 3.0. This third-generation trimmer features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to prevent manscaping accidents. It is waterproof. It has a cordless body, so you can take it in the shower and reach around to get those hard-to-reach spots. And I'm speaking from experience. Manscaped, it's the best. You don't have to worry about nicking your balls. You don't have to worry about getting cuts. You don't have to worry about razor burns. If you're shaving down there, which you should be, the quarantine is lifting. The quarantine is starting to lift. You got to get back to your normal routine, and you're going to need to start trimming. So why not use Manscaped? I'm telling you from experience that it is the most stress-free, anxiety-free shave for your men's grooming needs. And so, if you're a man and you have balls, you need Manscaped. So head on over to manscaped.com, use code GAYFAM20 at the end for 20% off and free shipping. That is 20% off and free shipping with any order. They don't just have only their razor. They have ball deodorant. They have ball toner. They have underwear. They have anything and everything to keep your family jewels in pristine shape. So if you are a man and you have balls, maybe you're a man and you like men with balls, maybe you can get him a Manscaped razor. I don't know. I just know that Manscaped is making my life easier. It should be making your life easier too. If you shave down there, you need Manscaped. That is manscaped.com. Use code GAYFAM20. All right, enough about balls. Now back to the show. Toxic side to masculinity that is damaging communities and individuals.
Well, so I personally stay away from the phrase toxic masculinity because I know that if I'm talking to a normie, which I define someone who's like, you know, just sort of
an average. And that's why I tried to retract it after I said it. I was like,
they'll immediately go, oh my God, liberal college professor, and start running for the exits as fast as they're like, hide them. And I'll be like, oh, come on back. Anyway, so look, let me take a little bit of historical perspective here. It's important for, I think, as long as we have a world where most people are identifying as male or female, even if we have more than just two genders and we recognize that there's intersex and so on. And I think, you know, even societies that have had a fair number of genders, that has been the case. We are going to need some sort of a positive archetype role model, something for them to latch onto. You know, people need these kinds of guidances. So having a masculinity for men, or various versions of masculinity, strikes me as a positive thing. But obviously there can be versions of that are just downright horrible and other versions of that which are much more positive. I mean, if you go back to the so-called traditional world, you had the knight in shining armor, defends the weak people, throws down his own life when necessary, kind of, let's call that positive in some sense. And then you had these other sort of vicious groups picking on the vulnerable going on kind of simultaneously in the same societies. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the reasons that you had this more elegant, chivalric version of masculinity was to protect people against this other kind that was more toxic. So yeah, I think we do need to try to find a positive, more modern form of masculinity. I don't think we should say that men are a problem. I don't think we should say the masculinity are a problem. I don't even think we should call it toxic masculinity. I would just point to specific behaviors. I think I have a general philosophy, which is that I agree there's such a thing as white privilege, but I never talk about that. Because if you're a skeptical person, and even if I convince you that the white privilege is a thing, it's like, okay, now what? Okay, now I've got you all, you're probably white privilege, do something. Okay, what are you gonna do? Like, if I talk to you about a specific issue, like this horrible shooting that just happened in Georgia a couple months
ago. Oh God, yeah.
Then we can say, hey, you know, violence against Blacks not getting treated properly by the justice system, or violence against Black men by police. It's a specific issue where there's specific solutions. And the same thing is true with masculinity. I'd rather focus, you know, on a particular behavior, whether it's homophobia or violence or anything like that, rather than talk about it in too general a term, because then it just becomes meaningless culture war stuff and you can never win.
I love that. And it turns people off. So if you talk about white privilege, you just say white privilege. Well, if you're white, you're just like, oh, screw that. I'm not going to listen. Like, you're just trying to invalidate me or whatever. But if you talk about specific issues, it's like, okay, you know, we're listening now.
Right.
So I love that. Let's talk about the Bible. So I guess you don't have to answer this question, but what are your thoughts on just, do you identify with a religion or follow any creed?
Yeah, no. So I think that's a completely legitimate question under this topic, because I mean, people have to know where I'm coming from. So right. I'm someone who was raised with a late mother who is low-key Methodist. I say low-key in the sense that she went through periods of attending church, and I know she was spiritual, but she wasn't like a Bible thumper, stereotypically speaking.
Sure.
And a father who was still alive, who was more of this intellectual atheist type. Mm. I probably started off more in my father's corner. And then I guess I'll just say this. I mean, some people will probably go, oh my God, are you serious? But I've had various spiritual experiences, which prompted me, after a lot of, no pun intended, soul searching, to decide that I ought to embrace some form of spirituality. And so I now refer to myself as a non-denominational Christian, and being the kind of person that I am a professor after all, snap in the sweep. I sort of, you know, dived, what's the past turn of dive, dove in, dive, what do you know what I'm saying, I've gotten into it in a way, you know, trying to educate myself about some of the issues, some things that are purely theological in nature, and other things that are more hot button, you know, political topics, like what's the Bible say about sexuality and things of that nature.
So identify as a Christian, I guess.
Yes, although the short answer is yes, the longer answer is though, but I'm not going around town proselytizing either. So,
perfect. Yeah. there's a ton of different, you know, ways to approach the Bible and what it says about homosexuality. You know, there's people that cite, you know, Leviticus and just say it's an abomination, that's set in stone. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And then, you know, we look into it more and we realize that it's written by man. It's inspired by God, but written by man. And ultimately, we have to decide for ourselves what we think the Bible is actually saying. What do you believe the Bible says about homosexuality and what those verses actually mean?
Well, so I think that the truly honest answer to that question is we don't actually know. Mm. Now the anti-gay argument that I have the least patience with is the one that you just cited from Leviticus. Mm-hmm. And there are two reasons for that. Reason number one is I'm still waiting to meet the person who cites that passage, thou shalt not lie with a man as I would with a woman, it's an abomination, blah, 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 who doesn't have a problem with lesbianism, but there's nothing in that passage about lesbianism. So what, in fact, there's really nothing in the Bible about lesbianism. So, I mean, you know, don't even come at me with general quote unquote homophobia about women too, if you're going to use the Bible to justify it. But the second reason though, is that that passage is in a part of the Bible that's explicitly, I mean, there's no doubt about it, trying to help the Jews define themselves in relation to the cultures that surrounded them at the time. Mm-hmm. And it includes other quote unquote abominations, like not mixing seeds in the same farmland. Got some farmer out there in Iowa rotating his crops. Well, he's going to be burned in hell. I mean, seriously. Yeah. It says no tattoos. Now, in fairness, there are a few Christian sects that don't have tattoos for that reason. But most people, I've literally seen footage of someone trying to defend the brutal killing of a gay person by one of his friends. This is really real footage. And his arm, he was citing Leviticus, and he had sleeve tattoos on both arms.
And the hypocrisy.
You know, the thing is, there's two places in Leviticus, they're close to each other, two chapters where that line about thou shalt not lie with is found, and literally right between them is the thou shalt not have tattoos stuff. The reality is that, so, you know, it gets into some of the history of Christianity, but, you know, in the early days of Christianity, There was this big decision that the Christians had to decide. Are they going to be a sect of Judaism, or are they going to go out and convert the Gentiles? And ultimately, we know how that turned out, right? They converted, and a big part of going out and converting the Gentiles was letting go of these old Jewish laws, which are, you know, pretty restrictive in terms of how you behave. Mm-hmm. And they let go of most of them, but for a variety of reasons, which have been controversial sent from the jump, some people are clinging to a couple that they find particularly congenial to their general desire to control other people's sexuality. So just forget the Leviticus stuff. There are some other things from the New Testament that people can also cite that could possibly be interpreted as being anti-male homosexual. Again, it's men, that are from the various writings of St. Paul. Epistles, letters, basically. He was a prolific letter writer in the days before DME. And in those letters, he uses various Greek words that honestly, we don't really know what they mean, but they seem to refer to things like don't be a slave trader for people who would become sex slaves. Do not become someone who exploits a sex slave. And sex slaves in those days would be both genders and could include prepubescent boys and things. Mm-hmm. There's just nothing there. And you know, that's just our best guess. I mean, because some of these words really, we don't have hardly any documents where they appear outside some of these letters. We're just doing the best we can to piece together the meaning. There's nothing that says, you know, don't have consensual sex with another man.
Sure.
Yeah. So the thing is, you know, I'm not going to tell a person, a Christian, oh, it's forbidden for you to interpret the Bible in a certain way that says homosexuality is a sin. I mean, everyone has their own process of discovery. But don't come at me with like the plain English of the Bible. The Bible is written in Hebrew and Aramaic and an ancient form of Greek that no one speaks anymore. And we don't really know what this stuff is. And frankly, your interpretation is really, really sus.
Yeah.
So that's the Reader's Digest version of it. Mm-hmm. But I want to rock your world with one more thing before you ask me a follow-up question. There is some evidence, albeit speculative, that the ancient Jews on whose culture this was based originally were totally fine with men doing their thing with mm-hmm. other men. Why? Because there's passages in Leviticus that are kind of written like, do not uncover your uncle's nakedness. And that's kind of a figurative way of saying you don't have sex with your uncle and don't have sex with your aunt. And then they kind of weirdly, suddenly transition to something more specific about just female relatives. That happens two or three times. And we can't prove it because we haven't found really early proto versions of Leviticus. But though to people who study these things, that's like a sign of later editing to a text. Do you feel like someone had the original line and they added this other thing? Now, if that's true, that's really interesting. Now, think about this. If there was a general prohibition against what we now call homosexual behavior between men, why would you need to specify that you shouldn't have sex with your man? You shouldn't have sex with your uncle. Mm. That's already covered by the blanket prohibition. We don't need all these other specific rules.
Right.
So that mean that at a certain period of time, that wasn't generally prohibited, which actually makes complete sense when you consider the general nature of the cultures from which ancient Judaism arose. So maybe the first Leviticus actually didn't even say that. So that's something, I mean, I can't prove that to you, but it kind of gives you a sense of how much more complicated this is than some of these homophobes want to pretend.
Sure, sure. And is there room to at least consider that, like maybe they didn't understand homosexuality in the sense that we understand it, that back in that day, like, you know, you needed a female to reproduce, and you needed, you know, communities were small and you needed armies and you needed whatever, like you needed more people. And so you had to have sex with females, and that, okay, so now this person wants to have sex with a man, but that's almost like, that's like a lust. Like that's not, they didn't understand that there was like, no, there's this attraction, this love. They didn't understand that the concept of a man loving another man. They just thought it was like an additional sex thing that didn't have any positive outcomes on the community. There's no baby being produced. There's, you know, is that a possibility?
I mean, certainly it's a possibility. I mean, certainly it's the case that Israel in those days seems to have found itself in a situation that was not that different from the modern Israel in the sense of being surrounded by cultures that weren't exactly pro-Israel, right? Mm-hmm. And smaller. So they would have wanted to have to promote procreation, which you do need a man and a woman for. I think the case for that is even stronger when you get to the New Testament, because we know a lot more about day-to-day Roman life than we know about ancient Jewish life, you know, another 1500 years prior in the past. And that there's just no, well, there are a couple things. When it came to the standard Roman household, the kind of gay sex that was happening was very, very, very different than what's contemplated today. You had a patris familias, this sort of very patriarchal head of the household who had could basically have sex with everyone that he wanted to have sex with, and that included the men, and not just theoretically, it typically would include the men. And so that's obviously that's just not consensual sex between two people who are in love. Here's something else, though. If I said the word eunuch to you, you would probably envision somebody who'd been intentionally castrated so that he wouldn't have any desire for women, so he could serve in the courts back in those days. He was an attendant for the king. The word eunuch back in those days, I'm talking the New Testament, it meant that, but it was actually a broader category that included what we would now think of as asexual, someone with no sexual desires, and someone who liked men instead. Basically, it meant a man who didn't have sexual attraction to women, regardless of what exactly the reason was, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Guess who, you know, the very first Gentile converted in the New Testament, so the first non-Jew to become a Christian, was an Ethiopian eunuch. In other words, the very first officially recorded person to become a Christian was a Black, possibly homosexual Black. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, awesome. It's an act. You can look it up. So I mean, the thing is, it's like, you know, put that in your pipe and smoke it if you're one of these homophobic types. I mean,
yeah.
Can I just back up here for a second?
Yeah, sure.
You know, I had these kinds of conversations with people who are more, you know, traditional conservative Christians. And, you know, they all very frequently, they will try to pretend that, oh, you know, I don't have anything against gay people, but I'm compelled, I tell you, by the Bible and the scripture to hate people and want them cast in, or just sit, you're going to hell. I just have, you know. And it's like, okay. So then I start to share with them some of these other ways of looking at these things. Frankly, I think they're more accurate, but whatever. There's certainly other reasonable ways of looking at these things. How would an open-minded person who is just compelled to be homophobic, in quotes, react to this new information? Oh, they'd be like, oh, you know, I really need to think about that. Maybe I can keep my Christian faith and have a different attitude towards gay people after all. That happens once in a blue moon. 20 times as often, 50 times as often, people just start either just reciting the very same passage in the Bible that I've just argued against without any acknowledgement of what I've said, or they just start pulling other random stuff. Oh, well, you know, Adam and Eve were both male and female and blah, 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 blah. And then just like, why are they clinging so fiercely to their homophobia? Well, obviously it's not the scripture that's driving their homophobia. It's their homophobia that's driving their interpretation of scripture. So I just will not let people hide behind their Christianity when it comes to the attitude they have. No, sorry, that's coming from you, bro, sis.
Right.
NB. Is there such a thing as an NB conservative Christian? Probably not.
And I want to talk about the hypocrisy of some religious people. Obviously, not all Christians. There's some beautiful, loving Christians, atheists, Muslim, whatever you identify as. But I'm glad that I actually found this out just now that you yourself are a Christian or identify as a Christian. So obviously, like you should be following, like, isn't Christianity about like love and spreading a positive message? Yet these people are hateful and wanting to, you know, harm other humans.
Well, I certainly think so. I mean, it's just, I mean, who are we trying to kid here? You know, I mean, when you're talking about, even if you believe, you're absolutely convinced that homosexuality is, let's say, a sin. Mm-hmm. Okay, so as long as that homosexual person isn't like committing some other crime that actually hurts you or your relatives or some third person, why not just wait to the quote unquote last day when your body is reunited with your soul and it's perfect form, blah, blah, blah. And you're judged by whatever, you know, according to whatever eschatology, you know, end of the world feeling that your particular branch of Christianity has. Is God is omnipotent. Is he not? He can sort these things out. You know, if it's really quote unquote abomination, he'll deal, or she or whatever, God will deal with it. the fact that people are so aggressive in dealing with this is even more so than with other sins that actually have a victim, like say adultery, tells you that this is just not really about that. Okay. There's a couple of functions happening here. One is a long-standing quote unquote tradition among parts of all three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, to control people's sexuality. And another, especially female sexuality, while we're at it, and also a way of giving the average person a chance to feel better about him or herself by looking down on other people. You know, I might have a downtrodden life compared to the rich patriarch who rules the world, but gosh darn it, I'm straight.
You got to straighten the camera.
I got so into it. And that's really bad. And, you know, look, I'm sure you know this, but we have, you know, all these churches, I don't even know if people know they're doing this. They're giving these donations, which are then being sent to various places in the world, like in Africa and so on, to assist some of these governments in implementing some of the most violently homophobic laws you can imagine, you know, at least in theory that gays should be rounded up and killed and stuff. And then they come and they say, oh, it's just about freedom of religion. I don't want to have to, like, you know, deliver pizzas to a gay wedding. Bro, you're not fooling anybody. You know what you would do if you had the chance? Because we see what you're doing over in Africa.
I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, you are familiar with, like, you teach business courses, and you're very familiar with the Bible and homosexuality. So what is your whole take on, you know, the whole Colorado Baker situation where they refuse to bake a cake for a gay couple and they cite their freedom of religion or freedom. Anyway, they cite, you know, their First Amendment rights and that they're a business and they don't have to serve anybody. So can you kind of deconstruct that?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to pretend to be one. But my personal take on this is that one could imagine certain things that are so intimately bound up in a religious faith that it's not fair to ask someone to do that if it's going to do something, if it's going to contravene their faith. Mm-hmm. Like I could see, you know, I certainly could see an exception for literally preachers, religious officiants, not having to be an officiant for a gay wedding if it's against what they believe. I mean, I personally think that's okay.
Okay.
And then you have other things at the far extreme, like, you know, you work in a bank as a teller and you refuse to count out money for a gay person because you don't like, because you're gays against your religion, which is just completely intolerable in any kind of a free society. And so between these two extremes, you have to find some dividing line where we're kind of saying, okay, this is close enough to being really, really part of your religion that we're going to allow basically an exception to basic civil rights principles, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like if it's just a cake, I don't think that the bakery should be allowed to do that. I mean, all they're being asked to do is bake a cake. I mean, maybe if it was going to have big letters like, we love pride, LGBTQ is the greatest thing in the world, that I can kind of see it because they don't believe in that message. Okay. But I mean, there were instances of pizza parlors refusing to deliver a pizza to a cheap gay wedding, you know.
Yeah.
What, all you gotta do is make the same pizzas you make for everyone else, drop them off, take your cash if it hasn't already been paid for with Uber Eats or something, and go on your way. No, that's just straight up discrimination. Okay. That's not. And what? Are you trying to tell me that you wouldn't go to Newt Gingrich's wedding, even though he's been divorced three times? Come on. Looking for an excuse to be homophobic.
And it's ridiculous because we're playing this scenario where everyone started doing that, you know, it's gonna, no commerce would be exchanged if everyone was doing that based on what they believed or what their perception of the other person was, right? Like,
we have these principles codified in the civil rights movement because of the way black people especially used to be treated. Like, you can't just simply say, well, I don't like black people, so I'm not going to serve you in my business.
Yeah. Right.
But I mean, you could get to a world where, you know, there was some liberal owner of a Starbucks like chain or something, and when social conservatives walk in or someone walks in with a MAG hat, sorry, we don't serve you. Yeah. How is that going to go over with the Colorado Baker? I mean, come on, you know, like, sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, my friend. So,
if God made gay people, or if gay people are, you know, we're going to go off the idea that being gay is not a choice. And if God made gay people, therefore, and then condemned them to hell, wouldn't that make God a sadist?
Yeah. So this gets into this sort of overarching theoretical question of, you know, why would God make people in such a fashion that they were strongly tempted to do seemingly harmless things in the sense that there's no victim, that contravene things that he thought were so incredibly important. I mean, I guess none of us can read God's mind, but it doesn't make a lot of logical sense, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that that's pretty silly. It doesn't really make any sense. And, you know, a lot of, you hear this all the time from people, being gay is a choice. But we know that for at least some core segment of the LGBT community, 4%, 5%, something, even in the most repressive societies that have ever existed on planet Earth, vis-a-vis gay behavior, they still can't love anyone but a member of their own gender. Okay, so if you want to tell some story about some bi-curious person who's only experimenting because things are more permissible now, go ahead and tell that story. But that's for this 4 or 5%, that's not the case. They could never be straight, pretend to be straight or anything else without being completely miserable, without knowing what love is or sexual pleasure. It doesn't, that's not a choice, folks. That's, and claiming it is just completely ignorant, right?
You know, totally.
Someone risk damnation, well, not damnation, you know, death penalty, torture, social ostracization if they could avoid it. It just makes no sense.
And there's a lot of animals in the animal kingdom that have homosexual tendencies. So I think that's, you know, yeah, at least an indication that it's in nature. You know, it's not like they, penguins wake up one day and decide to be gay.
Yeah, that's true. And by the way, the word abomination, as it's used in Leviticus, doesn't really mean what we think of. When we say abomination now, we mean like something just so horrible. Mm. But the way it's used in those, it just means like impure, you know, like not eating kosher food, literally. So that in the same Leviticus where they say, you know, don't eat rabbit because it has a cloven hoof, but it cheweth not the cud, and all these rules, don't eat birds of prey. It's really the same thing. It's on that level. It's the same word, abomination. So why are we, you know, even if it were a sin, it wouldn't be as bad a sin as people are claiming it is. You know what I'm saying?
They're right. Well, I forget where I heard this, but I was listening to something, some podcast, and it was basically saying that a lot of the rules written in Leviticus, they were rules because they were trying to protect their society, their community. Because what would happen is other, you know, invading nations or groups of people would come in, they would kill the people, they would rape the women, and they would start spreading diseases. So a lot of these sex laws that we see and these laws about don't eat pork and things like that, mm-hmm. it's because they were trying to protect that society. And obviously this was a time when there's no science, there's no protection, there's no condoms, there's no, you know, understanding of STDs. And so these people would come in and rape and steal and whatever, and they'd be spreading disease. And so it's like, yeah, don't have sex outside of marriage because this is what happens, because you're spreading disease, don't have sex with men because, you know, God knows there's STDs spread there. So I think a lot of these rules were written without the modern day understanding of how the world actually works.
Well, that's completely true, but it's once you start getting into the culture, the specific injunctions against sex, having sex with men, are in a place in the Leviticus generally that would lead one to believe it was a reference to having sex in these paganistic, to use the phrase, temples that neighboring cultures were doing. So they're basically saying don't engage in this particular pagan, you know, religious practice. Do you know what I'm saying? Which makes complete sense, because the Jews are trying to use these rules to define themselves as not as being Jews and not these other people.
Right.
As opposed to a general injunction that you know, I mean, look, there are some cases in the Bible, King David, for example, that sure look like, you know, they could very well have been, you know, gay love affairs. Doesn't quite say that, but it, you know, your antenna will go up when you're
the gaydar.
Yeah, no, seriously. I mean, right. So I mean,
That was actually, I was going to ask, do you think that there's any characters in the Bible that were gay? I guess you just mentioned David. Do you think there's anyone else
there's some suggestions that some characters, there might be a lesbian affair here and there, but you know, the thing is, the Bible doesn't spend a lot of time, and frankly, this is just generally true of literature, identifying heterosexual relationships as heterosexual. we're so, you and I and everyone else, so caught up in our heteronormativity that when you see a woman and a man, you know, react, you know, even without any kind of actual sex described or marriage as well, you know, obviously they're in love, you know, whereas if it's two guys or two girls, it's like, oh no, well, you know, they're just friends, you know, that's because you have these priors that are very strongly oriented one way or another. I mean, the Iliad, right? The Iliad, you know, the Troy and all this stuff with Achilles, Achilles and Patrocles. I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, based on the cultural norms of the day and all, everything else that's described about their friendship, there was probably a lot more going on than their friendship. Now, the Iliad does not have gay sex scenes in there, right? But, you know, that would have been, just based on the cultural milieu, that would have been surprising if they weren't having sex with each other, right?
Right.
This fact is just completely, well, fact, this reality of the cultural context is just completely glossed over, hidden, not talked about, you know, in thousands of, well, in conservative circles that don't want to admit that there's thousands of years of history of this kind of stuff being normalized much of the time. Mm-hmm. Or how about Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates? I mean, on the way men related to their teachers in that society, you know, just saying.
I saw a TikTok. So again, it's a TikTok. I mean, but this person seemed very, very, you know, well spoken. That said, like, Leonardo da Vinci was gay.
That's what you think, yeah.
Well, it's unfortunate.
He was an artist, so that's not confounding anyone's stereotypes here. But let's talk about macho people who were probably gay, like the old knightly orders, Knights of the Templars, other knightly orders back in, you know, the Crusades and stuff. There was a whole lot of gay sex happening in those orders. That is a historical fact. Cowboys, you know, the kind of tasteless jokes that people crack now about, oh, you're going to prison, blah, blah, blah. That's what people used to say if you signed up for these cowboy troops that were dealing with the cows out in the Western Plains in the 19th century. Mm. And in fact, I don't want to make light of it because it's a serious matter, but a lot of times when people first got involved in that kind of work, they were teenagers, 16, 17, 18, and there was sort of an understanding that they were going to be taking care of some of the older cowboys who, when they weren't doing that, were writing love songs to each other, which survived to this day. Now, when was the last time you saw a Western where anyone was talking about how much gay sex those people were having? It's just been completely under the rug. And these are like some of the most macho characters that we have in American history.
Yeah. Wow. Do you know where I could find that the love song? Is it, or the letters?
I think there's a book called The Tea Room Trade, which may cover some of this stuff. And there's, you could just, with Google, you can probably find this stuff fairly easily. My partner came riding up behind, and, you know, I walked for him. It's pretty obvious.
Yeah. Well, I had Dan Jinks on the podcast. He's the producer of American Beauty and Milk, the two fabulous movies, and he's gay himself. So I might want to, you know, shoot him an email and say, hey, look into the Tea Room Trade. You might want to get a movie started going on gay cowboys.
Hey, you know, the church that fairly or unfairly probably has the most, the quote unquote worst or strongest reputation for being coming down very, very hard on LGBTQ is the LDS, right? The Mormon Church, Latter-day Saints. Well, guess what? Based on letters written by the people who were traveling with Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, as they made their trek across the country, he really didn't care about gay couples. Mm-hmm. He was very, very anti-adultery. One strike and you're out. But as far as gay couples were going, you know, they were Bob and Jim or Sally and Susan over in this tent or whatever. Everyone knew what was going on and he didn't care. And now you would never, ever, ever believe that based on the LDS, you know, say, because again, people have this idea that it was anti-gay all 2000 years and all of a sudden the 60s happened. No, we've gone through periods of time when what we now call LGBTQ+, albeit in slightly different form, was much more tolerated. And then, you know, you'd have a religious revival or the winds of change would come. It's history's a lot more complicated than we think.
Sure. And it's a control tactic, ultimately. I mean, isn't it fair to say, at least to some extent, that the government officials or you know, people running for office, take up stances and make up stances or exaggerate their stances to rile certain groups up? Like,
yeah, I mean, there's a formula. It goes back thousands of years in all kinds of cultures, and we see it in American politics today, where you have an elite that has power, military elite, a religious elite, a business elite. Elites, by definition, do not have the numbers to control society by themselves. They wouldn't mm-hmm. if they were more than a few people. So they need to form a political, you know, coalition, if you like, with someone, some group that's lower beneath them. In the social hierarchy. Saddam Hussein did it with the Sunnis in Iraq, right? Mm. In modern America, you have a segment of, I hate to do this, but I've made TikTok on it, so I might as well. You know, lower middle class, upper working class, predominantly Caucasians of that socioeconomic group who have what you might call or have historically had cultural privileges. You know, it's like because you're white and not something else, because you're straight presenting and not something else, because maybe you're male and not a woman, et cetera. Christian nominally maybe and not something else, you're better. And you know, people can attach a huge amount of sense of self to these kinds of notions. And so when someone comes along, I wonder who this might be, and says, hey, all these crazy liberals who want to say that it's not so great to be a straight white male, that that's not better than anything else, well, they're terrible, and let me go show you I'm on your side by saying all these mean things to get them riled up. And then lo and behold, they become your president. So yeah. Yeah, even we saw this, I don't know, you remember, it's getting to be a while ago, but the previous Republican president did a lot of the stuff with gay marriage. When gay marriage had a lot of support, but not quite majority, they would put this on the ballot to get their followers to come out and, you know, vote against it. And while they're there, let's just vote Republican. Of course, public has moved so much that would no longer be a good tactic.
Sure.
in the 2000 timeframe.
I remember I was probably like 8 or 9 years old growing up in California when they had Prop 8 mm. which was marriage equality. It was on the ballot. I remember just in my household it had a sign that was vote yes for Prop 8, which was against marriage equality. Okay. That's the environment that I grew up in. So I do recall, you know, what you're talking about when they put things on the ballot to get Republicans to come out and vote. Go ahead.
I think we have to be fair. Like, if you went back to the 80s, I mean, I've never actually seen an opinion poll on this, but I'm just spitballing here, and just did a poll among self-identified gays, I wonder whether you wouldn't have gotten a majority to say they were also against gay marriage. Like, what? That's some straight institution. We don't need it. And then people campaign pretty hard. Andrew Sullivan is actually conservative, but he's also openly gay. He was like very strongly associated with this movement, and that kind of made it seem possible, maybe for the first time, that you could mainstream gay culture, that there would be you could just be live this sort of quote unquote standard bougie life, but be gay.
Yeah,
just completely alien. If you go back to 1985, and so I don't want to be too hard on people who were against gay marriage in 1997, you know, because they were actually the majority. But I'm less. It's one thing to be against gay marriage, another thing to be like homophobic. Those are not the same thing. You know what I'm saying? Mm.
Yeah. Do you care to elaborate on that? I think that's just an important point, especially for a lot of the younger listeners who are growing up with quote unquote homophobic parents or not accepting parents. I don't want them to resent their parents in any way, granted that they're not legitimately homophobic. So I guess what I'm saying, can you kind of deconstruct the line between accepting and then homophobic?
Yeah. I mean, look, it's one thing for a parent to say, to bust out with the stereotypical, well, I don't agree with your lifestyle line. Mm-hmm. And that's degrading and it might piss you off, but they're still going to be your mom and your dad. They're still going to pay for your college or if they were going to, you know, they're not going to change that. They're not going to throw you out of the house. It's just one of these things that you'll differ on, and maybe you have some time to work on them, and maybe they'll meet your girlfriend or boyfriend someday and realize, oh, hey, you know, I can still have a normal, you know, they'll become more accepting over time, possibly.
Sure.
And then you have these other people who, you know, as soon as they catch any wind of something that's contrary to their gender norms, like they see their boy playing with a doll or something, they smack that person. Don't you do that. That's gay. Or the kid comes to them when the kid's like 15, 16 and says, you know, hey, I'm gay or something. And the parent just flips, completely loses control. This is the extreme case, and throws the child out of the house. That's just outright hateful behavior. You know, I mean, you're basically playing God at that point. You're not just simply saying, well, I have a certain interpretation of things and how things should be. I'm actually going to enact a punishment on you. That is, there's just simply no justification for that whatsoever. But it also gets you into this issue. I mean, obviously coming out is a very personal thing. You can't really tell other people what to do. But if you have reason to believe that you might actually be thrown out of the house or disowned because of this, you might want to time that till when you're the coming out aspect, until when you you're financially independent.
So, yeah, I totally agree, and I get that question all the time. I make a few videos on it. Just basically, my stance is that if you legitimately fear your safety, your physical safety, meaning you're going to get beat up, or your financial security, meaning you're going to get thrown out of the house or cut off, you know, from finances, then it's probably the best idea to not come out at that moment until you get to a point where you are financially secure and you're no longer in physical harm.
Yeah.
So we just talked for over an hour. I really appreciate that. I think we had a great conversation. I really enjoyed, you know, learning more about the pay gap as well as just the Bible and what homosexuality really means in the Bible. So I appreciate your time.
Well, I've had a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Anytime. I'd love to talk. We can do it again.
Yeah, let's stay in touch.
All right. Appreciate it. You have a great day.
Bye.
Thank you all so much for listening. You are all so beautiful and amazing. Make sure to check out Professor Ross over on TikTok. That is at Professor Ross, ProfessorRoss. He also has his website, davidgaddisross.com. That's David and then GADDISRoss.com. And then he is on Instagram as well @the_professor_Ross. Go check him out. He's a great guy. Make sure to check us out at www.thealphabetmafia.com. You can read our blogs there. You can support our brand. Get a sticker. Get yourself a sticker. That really helps us. It raises brand awareness. You put it on your water bottle. You put it on your laptop. It becomes more of a common thing seen around town. If you want to be featured on our YouTube show where I answer your DMs and emails regarding, you know, your situation you're in or needing advice, you can email us at info@thealphabetmafia.com. Again, that's info@thealphabetmafia.com. Just put in the headline LGBTQ+advice, something like that, and I will try and read it and then use it on the show. Of course, if you need serious help, you can visit the trevorproject.org or you can give them a call at 1-866-488-7386. If you are in need of serious help, please reach out to those people immediately. They will be more than happy to help in a tremendous way. Thank you all for tuning in, and I hope you have a beautiful morning, evening, whatever it is. Good night.